So this part was going to come first. So maybe you can do the connection back the other direction. So it's a privilege to preach here this morning. It will be a pleasure to meet you afterwards. I always find it very difficult to talk about myself. I'm starting my theology training quite late in life. I started when I was 50, after raising a family of five, though we still have two of them hanging around. All of my life I was in a very fundamentalist sect, and so some of those lessons which I just explained about the salt, yeast and light were quite late revelations to me in life. I was in one of those very exclusive churches where you knew everybody and everybody knew you and you knew nobody else, basically. So that's been quite a journey, as you can imagine, over the last 6 years. This morning I'm going to be talking also about community, again on the same theme. And this is about the early church and Jesus' ideals for community life. I've called it the kingdom viral. That's the salt, yeast and light aspect. Some of those themes are picked up now. Now this is a reading from Acts 2, about the very early church, immediately after Pentecost. After the preaching by the apostles, were they just disciples at that point? I can't remember. It says, "Awe came upon everyone, because many wonders and signs were being done by the apostles. All who believed were together, and they had all things in common. They would sell their possessions and goods and distribute the proceeds to all as any had need. Day by day, they spent as much time together in the temple. They broke bread at home and ate their food with glad and generous hearts, praising God and having the goodwill of all the people. And day by day, the Lord added to their number those who were being saved." Now, this is a key text about the early church. It's an insight so brief that it could easily have been left out of the record. And I wonder what we would know about early church practices without it. Luke, who wrote Acts, claims that the early Christians, all of them new converts, met often, shared property, and met daily for a common meal. They saw this as a continuation of Jesus' shared life with others, including his meals with many different kinds of people. This was the nature of his kingdom, sharing across social barriers, and his earliest disciples understood this. Christian meals for all, these are very old frescoes, by the way, I think they're in the catacombs in Rome. Christian meals for all, and especially the needy, are the most common motif of the early church. To fund this, it was necessary to bring in all available assets and appoint officers to manage proceedings. But however they worked it out, they saw practical material help as an essential part of their new life in faith. We usually see this description of the sharing and caring in the early church as something unusual and remarkable. We wonder how long this selfless communal living was possible and whether we could ever imagine living like this today. We may think of utopian hippie communes in the 60s and 70s. Or Israeli kibbutzim. And we wonder if this is how Jesus really expects us to live as Christians with everything in common. Oh, here comes the bread.
Very exciting. Oh.
We have great resistance to economic sharing in today's modern capitalist individualistic societies. Is such an approach either possible or advisable today? And if not, how can we live kingdom values in our present culture? We may easily miss in our readings of the Gospels and of Acts how much poverty there was in Jerusalem and Judea in the early first century. Jesus talks about the poor and the oppressed, but maybe we think that was only a fraction of the population. The truth is that there was a small percentage of elite people who were wealthy or well-connected, such as the Sadducees or the Herodians, as they were also called. And the Pharisees devoured widows' houses, we know that. And then there was the vast majority of people who were not wealthy or even comfortable. The poor in Jerusalem were not the other, they were the norm. In fact, most of the early Christians and their neighbours were poor, living at subsistence level. So daily communal meals did make a lot of sense, given their economic situation. The poor lived and conducted their business on the street. They were on the street, or in a little shop opening onto the street, all day. They saw lots of people every day, and they were aware of every aspect of poverty and suffering. But as in every era, the rich tried to shield themselves from having to see it. They associated with each other behind walls and by keeping to themselves as much as possible. And when they had to go through the markets, they hurried through, kept their gaze down, and didn't touch or talk to anyone. Jesus, however, was constantly on the street, mixing with all kinds of people. Sometimes he would venture into synagogues, sometimes he would have dinner with Pharisees, but most of the time he was out on the street. What does that make him? It made him one of the poor. Now, Jesus applied a special model of community to his disciples. It was a model which was novel at the time, and it's what anthropologists call the fictive kin group. Fictive, as in the word fiction, and kin group, as in family. So it's like, let's pretend we're real family. We might call it an intentional community now. Now, why was this necessary? Why? Didn't society already have itself all set up, functional? Well, it helps to know a little bit about how this ancient society worked. Persons did not identify as individuals as they do in Western society, but as part of some kind of kin group. If you didn't have a kin group, you were in trouble, both socially and financially. Within any kin group, all the members were obliged to help each other, maintain an open home if they had one, be loyal, terribly one-eyed about everybody in that group, and to tell the truth. That was mandatory. You had to tell the truth to your brothers and sisters who were in your kin group. This was mandatory because inequality, conflict, and betrayal could threaten the survival of the whole group. But outside the kin group, however, no obligation existed. Outsiders had no right to the truth. It was perfectly honourable to lie to them, betray them, and exploit them. We see that today in some cultures in the world where deception and corruption are normal. And if you go there, it's quite a shock, isn't it? Now, we might assume that everyone in the ancient world belonged to some kin group. Yet this was not the case, especially in urban areas. There were lots of social rejects, debt slaves, foreigners, younger sons who received no land inheritance, the disabled and the mentally ill, children sold into slavery, a vast number of abandoned babies, which was the usual form of contraception in ancient Rome, disowned girls who had been compromised in some way, widows, divorced wives, and prostitutes. Many of these social rejects drifted to urban centres like Jerusalem, where poverty, death, and disease were common. People's health was very poor and life expectancy was very short. Many children died in infancy, and those who survived lost at least one parent before maturity. Most poor people in Jerusalem at the time of Jesus would have seen themselves as socially deprived. So, given that situation, the hunger for the benefits of a kin group would have been very great for many people. The comfort of belonging, open homes, trust and loyalty rather than suspicion, and the gift of truth-telling rather than chronic suspicion, deception, and fraud. People in the Roman Empire were used to being lied to by those who were not theirs, their own people. For those who had no kin group, they expected to be lied to pretty much by everyone. Everyone was into survival, on the take, on the make. Truth was more rare and precious a commodity than safe drinking water, So when Pilate asked, what is truth? He probably didn't have some philosophical question in mind, not some great religious truth in mind. It was just the burden of having to be a judge in a society where everyone lied, as a matter of course. And it was fine, it was honourable. Unless, of course, it was to your own kin group, and then it was shameful. So the story of the beginning of the church in Jerusalem is the story of the formation of a new kin group. There's the widows and the orphans. The values of Christianity were not unheard of, actually. But until then, they were offered only to members of your own clan. Jesus said, anyone who loves mother, father, etc. more than me is not worthy of me. Shocking thing to say in that particular social culture. Yet even as Jesus criticised the biological family unit, he set up its replacement. He said that the highest loyalty is now to the community of disciples rather than to blood relatives. So the Jerusalem believers, in those little verses we read in Acts 2, how they shared everything, they had communal meals, they weren't doing anything unusual. All the kin groups did that. They all had open homes, they all shared, they all had their property in common. And if you had a lot of property, there was just no way you could get out of not sharing it with your kin group. And this is why the Jerusalem community had no needy people among them, as they were without a needy person. The communal sharing, which Luke describes, was similar to the generalised reciprocity that went on all the time in extended families. What was different, what was radical, was about who the kin were. How inclusive was this Jesus-centred fictive kin group? Well, both Hebrews and Hellenists were part of it. The lowest classes of society were also included. Tradespeople, slaves, and beggars. We know that because members of those classes are mentioned in places in the Gospel. In early Christianity, women were not only accepted, but many of them became leaders, as we see through the names in Romans 16. Celsus, a second century pagan critic of Christianity, declared that where other mystery religions, these are the pagan religions, invite the pure and the righteous, Christians invite the crooks and the simpletons, yes, and women and children, and the very teachers are wool workers and cobblers and laundry workers. He also once taunted that the Christians are able to convince only the foolish, the dishonourable, and the stupid, and only slaves, women, and little children. There is a fresco of a woman preaching in the early church. So how do we apply these accounts of early Christianity to such a different society as ours? Shane Claiborne wrote, "The greatest tragedy in the church isn't that rich people don't care about poor people, but that rich people don't know poor people." The amazing thing about the early church is because it broke down all social barriers, it brought rich and poor together in communal meals, and this is how they became aware of each other. Sometimes all it takes is just being aware of someone's needs to fill them. It's not like you're mean or selfish by not filling needs of others, you just don't know about them. The early church brought these people together. So if you had a house and you had means and you were a wealthy person and somebody needed some legal assistance, or just something as basic as food and shelter, or they needed a message to be sent across the empire for some urgent reason, you were in a position to help them, and often it would be no big deal to do that, as long as you knew that need was there. But this presents us with some problems today, because our society has long been Christianized, and there are many structures already in place to provide for people's basic needs. A few pages are out of order. Let me just find them. There it is. 7, 8, 9. I got a bit jumbled when I did the thing back to front. Here we are. Thanks to Brian putting page numbers on my printout. So this is where we may ponder this issue and get no closer to any practical course of action, except perhaps to increase our contributions to charities that will assist the poor on our behalf. What else can we offer or share? How does the kingdom grow in the world now? So this is something that we can discuss. From there I was going to move into the salt, yeast and light, and how we're actually not supposed to be clumped together and living our Christian life only together. We're supposed to be out there being one less liar, one less cheat, one less abuser, one less hater, one less snob. Just, I have an image in my mind of a Petri dish with agar jelly in it. If you scattered over the surface of that Petri dish a very small number of bacteria, each one would grow. Each one would grow, and after a while they would all join up and cover the whole Petri dish with a culture. And I do believe that this is what Jesus is talking about, with his images of growing, you know, of salt and yeast and light and seeds and things. He didn't expect Christians to take themselves out of society and only look after each other and themselves, but that we should be out there making a difference in a very tiny way, because lots of little tiny things together make a big thing. And I realise this is probably all very old news for you all, but in the context of how it was in the early century, early first century, it's how it is now. We're in a very different society, aren't we? And we can't live communally. We can't live like that. So has anyone got any thoughts about how you can take those basic principles and bring them into our society now? And yes, well, we're all going to be in different environments, in different stages of our life. And I look back now on when my kids were that age in school, and of course I was in a very exclusive fundamentalist sect, which we weren't supposed to talk to anybody, you know. And we kept ourselves to ourselves, and I outreached not at all and spoke to no one basically at all, dropped the kids off, picked them up, sat alone in the quadrangle waiting for them. And clearly that's not doing any good to anyone, is it? How could things have got so wrong? So you have a great opportunity there. And it doesn't have to be anything, shall we say, preachy or spectacular. It just has to be one mum who treats everyone well, who is genuinely interested in other people and their kids, who is willing to pick up, drop off, to volunteer for stuff. A safe mum who people feel like if the kids come to your house, they're going to be well looked after. All these things are the marks of a Christian.
The great thing about this is it doesn't have to solve what it doesn't have to be anything that it isn't. It just has to basically live.
Yep.
In other words, it's not quite understandable, but it's not going to do anything. It's just being who we are, fundamentally who we are. And it's the being of who we are, not the taking on some sort of external carapace or whatever that can be that is.
Look, people can pick up falsehood a mile off. They can pick up when they're being evangelized falsely, like, you know, as an effort. You know, when you're putting it on to try and make people think that you're nicer or better than you are. How about just be that person and just interact like that? That's great. and people can see straight away that you're a safe, genuine, helpful, caring individual. In what often in the world is not that way.
Sometimes it's not people that you get to know either, just going down to the local shop and smiling at people as you're walking in and out. And
it's true, yeah.
Just being friendly.
That's so true. It makes a big difference. We walk around in our little bubbles sometimes, don't we? And I certainly notice that if somebody has got their outward-looking face on and they're looking to catch my eye and interact in some way, you know, it's all sometimes a bit confronting. But I'm always glad if someone does that because, you know, I tend to shut down and walk around in my little force shield, you know. if there are people that prepare to do that, that's great. How lovely. Street party. Very nice. I'm afraid we've never had one of those.
I'm interested in what you said about the people in the early church, the people in the teaching.
Let's speak up, Peter, I can't hear.
Okay. In the early church, you were saying the people who did the teaching were also the poor people, the kind of the rest of them were down. Today, that area of the teaching tends to be dominated by people who are educated in the class and who've been through places like you and I study at. Is this wrong?
Well, I'm hoping that out of this talk, you will pick up for yourself that I actually think things have changed a lot. And that any delusions that we can live as early first century Christians is just that, delusions. Oh my goodness, look at this. How beautiful is that? How beautiful is that bread? Mmm. Oh. All we need is a big chalice of wine and we've got communion. And this is why I think it's good to exercise our mind on what's changed. It's no point, you know, doing this sort of retro nostalgia thing and trying to be like that because society isn't like that. So what has changed and how can we adapt these ideas of the kingdom viral, of things scattering and growing into the kind of lives that we live now? As I said, lives where it's in the society is post-Christian, where it's where there are a lot of safety nets in place for a lot of people. I understand a lot of people fall through them, but there are still, you know, basic needs being met. How do we make the world a better place? That's what we have to think about. I'm not asking you. I'm just saying it's a rhetorical question. It's a different world now. It's like Jen's ready to go. Thank you.